The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
I am delighted to be joined by our next guest, author, TV personality, Dawn O'Porter, who's here today to talk about her lovely new memoir, Hungry Eyes. Dawn, you are very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I had the pleasure of reading the memoir over the weekend, and I have to say, I think women of a certain vintage, when they hear Hungry Eyes, think of a certain movie and a certain character and a certain song, which has been in my head since Friday. Was that intentional?
It was intentional, but up until about 4 minutes before the cover went to print, the book was called What I Bring to the Table. And then we were just discussing on email. I said, I'm going to post the cover on Instagram and I'm going to use the song Hungry Eyes, which would also have been a great name for this book. And the whole email chain just kind of goes quiet for about 10 minutes as we're like, oh God, that is such a good name for this book. And then the art department did a very quick turnaround and we still made the announcement on time, but with an entirely different title. And I'm so happy we did it.
Oh, so it was literally a very last minute thing. And it was a play on that wonderful scene in Dirty Dancing, which I think most women of our vintage have watched 1,000 times.
At least.
Let me talk about the memoir, because it is a really beautiful read, I have to say. And you talk a lot about food and your relationship with food. And you talk a lot about different episodes throughout your life where food in some ways played a really central role in your understanding of what was going on. I was particularly moved, I have to say, Dawn, by the passages that discussed your mother's death. You lost your mum at a really young age, just before your 7th birthday. And you talk about people who've experienced trauma at a very young age like that, attaching themselves to something. And for you, it was food.
Yeah, I think a lot of people attach themselves to something, whether it's you know, a person or a substance, or can very often be something negative, can very often be something positive. But for me, it was food. I just immediately turned to food as being the thing that brought me joy. And I think that was largely wrapped around the fact that mealtimes were really distracting from all the really sad things that were happening. And everyone, you know, you put food on the table and there is this kind of communal thing that happens where you've got something else to think about, something else to talk about. And I felt that very deeply as a child, that would just kind of long for lunch or long for dinner, because it would all feel a lot less awkward. You know, my mum was very ill upstairs and then she was gone. And so it was sad at times, but food brought this release. And I still, you know, still to this day, if I've experienced, I'm not one of those people that loses my appetite when I'm upset. I just have
never
the exact
experienced that.
Never experienced that. When people are like, oh, I haven't eaten because I'm stressed and upset, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. What happens? I will still find myself, you know, right, okay, something's gone wrong, something's making me sad, get into the kitchen, cook something, put it on the table, bring everyone together, and that will make everything feel better for at least, you know, 20 minutes.
It was sort of a relief of the tension that everybody was feeling in the house. I mean, you write about, obviously, the experience of losing your mum and the aftermath of that when you were living with your granny and granddad, your nan and pops, and how at one point, Dawn, you were so, I suppose, traumatised by what had happened to you and your young sister that you were actually diagnosed incorrectly with epilepsy.
I mean, it's so 80s, I think, that story.
It made me laugh, and then it sort of made me really sad.
It is. It's mad. It's the most 80s thing I think that I could possibly write about the 80s. But it was, I kept having these, I would, in crowds, I would just go into this kind of dream, dizzy state where I would kind of glaze over and almost detach myself completely from what was going on. And my auntie would refer to them as my funny turns. And I couldn't control them. I would just be fine. And the next minute, I was suddenly really drunk. And I remember kind of saying to her that it's getting more and more frequent and it's quite weird. And then I went to Brownies one night and my brown owl woman, whoever brown owl was, said to me, I think you're epileptic, this is epilepsy. So you can't cycle home, I'm going to drive you home, we're going to tell your family that you're epileptic. So we got driven home, she announced to my family that I was epileptic, went to the doctor the next morning, yep, Dawn's epileptic, put on epilepsy pills. And that was that. And then a few months later, I was like, this is they weren't suiting me, the pill. So I went back to another doctor who had a bit more of a heart and said, Dawn's not epileptic, she's traumatized. And this is a really standard reaction to a kid who has, you know, been through something really difficult. So I went off the epilepsy pills, never you heard that word again. And then just, you know, just cracked on. There was no medicine for what was actually happening.
But were you relieved, I suppose, to even have that recognized, that you were traumatized?
Yeah, the acknowledgement of it was great. You know, this is the 80s. It wasn't that it was a forbidden subject in my house, but it's not like we all sat around talking about the fact that she died. And there was no therapy. I went back to school 2 days later and no one ever mentioned it at school again. You know, you just kind of, it was very much that happened and now you have to get on with your life. And I feel like, you know, I've seen this happen in today's world. Kids are very, you know, supported, and there's therapy and charities and all sorts of things that are there to get them through it. But back then it was, that's not really what happened. And so I think the acknowledgement of someone saying to me, you've been through something horrific and that might affect you, was a real relief.
Because you write that you were never told that your mum was dying. That wouldn't have been, I suppose, the approach in the 80s. But you had an awareness because she was so sick, because she was failing in front of your eyes, because the grown-ups all around you were carrying such tension. Do you wish you had known?
It's really hard to know what the best thing to do for a 6 and an 8 year old is when their mum is dying. Like, really sadly, I've just lost a friend of mine, and she had kids exactly the same age as I was when my mum died, and they were in America. Now, that was dealt with like endless therapy, family meetings. It was all so on the table. And I was watching it happen, go, God, this is a lot too. This is almost too much in the other direction. But I didn't even know she was dying. I just got told one day she was dead. And I think there's a space in the middle that is probably right. I don't know what I would go back and change. I knew something was happening and I didn't know what it was. I never got to say goodbye to her and I didn't get to go to her funeral. I think if I could go back in time, I would have gone to the funeral, because I think when anyone dies, closure is the most important part of the whole process. Being able to, you know, just, I don't know, have a moment where you can see that it's over. But I don't think at that age I really ever believed that she'd fully gone. So you kind of wait for her to come back, because no one's ever really said she's not coming back. And I think that's no one's fault. And I think it was a sign of the times. And I also thought it was everyone doing their best to protect us. And I think in many ways at the time, maybe it felt like the right decision. It's just me as a, you know, 47-year-old woman now wishing that I'd been at my mum's funeral, because I would like the memory of it. I think my issues in life came from being completely disconnected from the most traumatic thing that had ever happened to me. And I think the right way to deal with something like that is to let kids be a part of the experience. But I never want this to sound like I'm angry at anyone in my family, because I'm really not. Everything was made with the decision of what was right, you know?
And what was sort of known at the time.
Totally. So it's no one's fault and it's all okay. But you can't help but go over what the other approach would have been.
And how that could have played out later in life. Because you say in the book, you didn't want to be sad, right? So you wanted to be the funny one. Perhaps it was to break the tension or bring some happiness back into the room. So you were all jazz hands and attention seeking. Do you think that fed into the career that you then sought out and how you navigated all of that?
100%. I don't think it's any coincidence that I went into a career which is entirely based on attention seeking. And validation from other people. You know, along with food as a child, being on stage had a very similar, you know, effect on me. It's like when I'm up on stage, I'm not thinking about that thing. No one else is thinking about that thing. And I'm able to break away from this kind of this tragedy inside of me. So that was a huge part of my life. There was no way I was ever going to give that up. You know, the feeling of I don't know. I mean, I consider myself, I'm not an actress anymore. I write books. I consider myself to be an artist. Without my trauma, I don't know if my art exists. It's been the backbone to everything I've ever done. It's in a horrible, dark kind of way. It's been the material that's probably made me quite successful. You know, it's all stuff that makes you the person that you are. Not that you may necessarily realize that until you're an adult, but I would never, obviously, I'd wish my mother had never died, but she did, and therefore I had to build it into my life, and I turned it into art eventually.
It was interesting. I was reading a piece with comedian Alan Davies yesterday in one of the Sunday papers, and he was asked, what did you wish you'd known when you were younger? And he said he'd also lost his mum at a really young age. And he said, I wish I'd known that life is not linear. Your past stays with you, but that's okay. It's all part of who you are.
All part of who you are. And any tragedy, any experience that you're going through will eventually become a story that you tell about yourself. And when you're in the eye of the storm, that's almost impossible to imagine, but it's just true. And, you know, I think to experience like hardcore trauma as a 6-year-old is really brutal, but to experience trauma at any age is really brutal. At some point, you just realize that you've built it into your DNA and it's a part of who you are.
And you get the sense reading the book that it has really impacted how you mother your own children in terms of making food with them, sitting at the kitchen table, eating with them, talking with them, consciously spending time with them, consciously filling their little memory banks.
Well, I think that's more to do with my auntie than my mum, actually. My auntie that raised me, I moved in with her when I was 10. And she was this amazing cook and just used to have people over for dinner parties and big Sunday lunches all the time. And that was such a joyous part of my life growing up, that, you know, the fact that our house was the party house. I just loved it. The fact that dinner time, anything she cooked for us, it was never a chore. It was never, I didn't live in a house where I was like, oh, you know, the woman's doing all the cooking and she's annoyed about it. And it was just such a pleasure for her to feed us, her brilliant recipes and the effort that she put in. And knowing how good that felt for me as a teenager, I just want my kids to know that our kitchen table is where the good stuff happens. You know, it's not, I don't think that stems from my tragedy. I actually think that stems from the great things that happened to me as a kid, and the fact that our dining room at my auntie and uncle's house was literally my favorite place to be. It was just brilliant. And so when I feed my kids, I want them to feel that way about our house. We have people over all the time and I make a lot of effort with their food, and I never want them to feel like me taking care of them is functional and stressful.
No, and you do get that from the book when you write about your Auntie Jane and your Uncle Tony, who you moved in with, that their kitchen table was all about connection and togetherness. There's another funny section in the book which really did make me laugh, and you talk about the diet culture of the 1980s and how it seeped into all of our impressionable minds, which meant that you couldn't melt gracefully into the joy of the perimenopausal spread. It was literally impossible. And there is one story in the book that really made me smile, and this was you being on a diet and Jamie Oliver sending you a hamper to cheer you up.
He did. It was 2021. The time was 2021. We were in Toronto. Chris was doing a movie. It was still heavily, heavily pandemic-y and at the most brutal lockdown that we'd experienced so far. I couldn't leave the house, wasn't allowed to do anything. It was 10 inches of snow outside, so even if you did leave the house, it was awful. And I'd put on so much weight over 2020 because I was basically eating charcuterie boards and margaritas for breakfast. And then so I decided to go on a diet and, you know, do strength training on Zoom and restrict my calories. All awful, which I hate doing. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And I was chatting to Jamie Oliver one day on Instagram, and I must have just sounded so miserable. And so he said, "What's your address? I'm going to send you something." And the next morning, two giant paper bags full of an Egyptian brunch turned up from his friend's place in Toronto. And despite my calorie intake supposed to be quite small, I ate everything. I ate it all, like my life depended on it. I was so hungry and so happy. And I was like, I can't believe this came from Jamie Oliver. This would be so rude not to eat every last bit. So That was it. I still ended up losing the weight I wanted to lose. Goes to show that you can treat yourself whenever you want. It'll be fine.
Yeah, and it also goes to show it's not what you know. It really is who you know in this light. And we've spoken to you about how your mindset has changed a little about your career and what's important to you. Do you think these things change as we age?
I do. I mean, look, I'm still, you know, very into my job and write a lot and work very hard. But my goal has changed. You know, as a young girl living on Guernsey, I just dreamt of superstardom. That was the goal. I didn't really care how I did it, what was going to happen, how I got there. I was just going to get there. And, you know, I moved to Hollywood and I did all these really fun things. And now my relationship with what is success has changed. For me, success now is that I continue to get to write my books and that I have an audience of, you know, readers who love my books. That to me is so successful in my eyes. It's not like megastardom and what I always dreamed of when I was a kid, but it is the best job I could dream of. I also see my family life as such a part of my success. You know, it's not just work that I focus on. I see my happy, healthy kids and my marriage and my five pets and the life that I love in London. That's all the success, you know. And I think when you're freelance, you go through, you can have, it's feast or famine, you know. You can have a great few months and you can have a low few months, but it's the important thing is to look at the whole picture of your life. And I never used to be able to do that. I just used to see work as the only thing that made me successful. And I think that's what's changed as I've got older, is that if work is slightly slow, but everything else, all my family is thriving, I'm successful.
That is,
you know,
success. But yeah, you've also made some real changes to your life, Dawn, haven't you, in terms of your attitude to exercise, your attitude to alcohol, your attitude to beauty treatments. You've cut out the Botox, cut out the Profilo. I think you've really looked like you've figured out what's important.
I have. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to cut out Profilo and Botox forever. Can we just make that very I'm going through a current, very natural phase, which I'm quite enjoying. I think the thing with aging, you don't know what you're in for and you deal with it as it comes up. But I did get Botox when I turned 40. Got it for a few years. Loved it. Think it's great. Stopped last year. Very happy with my face. There's absolutely no reason to get it. But the big one for me has been giving up alcohol, which no one cares about. No one wants to talk about. It's so boring. And I never thought it would be me. But
I don't think it is again, boring, because I think lots of people actually are really sober curious and want to know what difference could it make to their lives.
I mean, for me, it was a case of, you know, I was a big drinker. I loved drinking. For years, it was great. And I have a really good relationship with alcohol. Like, nothing went wrong at all. I was just sick of being hungover. And I started to realize that the balance had slipped. I was spending more time feeling awful than I was having fun being drunk. And I just got that feeling of waking up in the morning and just not wanting to face the day and going to my office, that I've got this beautiful office that I write in, and going and just lying on the sofa and needing to sleep all day. I was like, this isn't working for me anymore. It's not actually fun anymore. And I've got to the point now where I'm not afraid of a dance floor sober. Love it. I go to everything. I love going out. I still feel just as sociable. I still host just as much at home. I'm just not drinking alcohol, and it's, you know, a year and a half in, I just I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything, what apart from hangovers. So
but did you feel like you had to sort of adjust yourself and readjust to how you sort of presented yourself at all these social occasions without alcohol?
Not massively. And the reality is that I realised about myself, and I know this isn't the same for everyone else, but I don't have social anxiety, so I didn't know why I was drinking like I did. And I think in many ways, sometimes the booze gave it to me. It would give me such fear the next morning about all the things that I've said. But I can very confidently walk into a room and have a great time. And then you realised, I don't need the alcohol to do that. The alcohol is making me repeat myself, spit in everyone's faces and get quite annoying. And when I don't drink, I don't do the things that make me feel annoying.
No, you don't sound annoying at all, Dawn, I have to say.
Well,
Sober Dawn is lovely.
I'm sure my husband would sing a different song. But I just feel like at this point in my life, I don't feel like I'm missing anything. I still visualise myself as being an old lady with a sherry. So we'll see how it goes. But it just wasn't, it wasn't suiting me. And there's something that is really, really satisfying about doing a whole night out, being on the dance floor, having a great time and realizing that you didn't have a drop of alcohol.
Yeah, and hopping in your car to get home. Well, the book is called Hungry Eyes by Dawn O'Porter. It is your first full memoir, and it really is a lovely, lovely read. And there's some beautiful recipes actually right throughout the book as well, which I intend to experiment with when I invite lots of people around to my kitchen table over the next few weeks, because I really did feel inspired. Dawn O'Porter, a real pleasure talking to you today.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.